She came.
Where?
There.
It's time for the SAFTAcast, the only podcast that talks to writers, editors, and publishers about everything except writing, editing, or publishing. I'm your host, Scott C. That is my full name, Scott C. Welcome to the program, episode 51, an amazing episode indeed. But a lot to tell you about and update you on. First and foremost, let me kick this off by saying congratulations. Back in AWP a few weeks ago, we had a contest. If you posed for a selfie with the SAFTAcast coffee mug that was in Los Angeles, you had a chance to win a prize pack. You might recall us talking about that, and we do have winners indeed. So congratulations go out to Billy Marie Robinson and Leslie Salas, our two big winners from this year's mugshot contest. Speaking of the podcast for a second here, we are still on the hunt for an intern at this program to help us out on a number of little fronts and such and be a part of this program and contribute your time, your talents, and your abilities to continuing to provide people with wonderful, awesome conversations. But, my friends, the deadline is approaching really quickly for that. In fact, it is just a few hours away, midnight, April 29th. That is this Friday. Might be today if you're listening to us. If not, you're listening to us in the future and the date has passed. Time travel is hard on tenses when you don't know exactly when someone will. Never mind. The point is the deadline. You have just a little bit of time left to get those applications in. And to do so, send us your application at saftacast@gmail.com and we shall be in touch. But a SAFTAcast internship is not the only one that is up right now. SunTrust Academy for the Arts and SunTrust Publications is looking for a number of interns. To find out all about those, visit sundresspublications.com. And while you're there, if you click on SunTrust Academy for the Arts in the menu bar, it will take you to the SAFTA website. And there, if you look closely, you will see information about two of our retreats. We've talked about this last year and perhaps the year before that. The SunTrust Poetry and Fiction Retreats. They are happening once again this year. The Poetry Retreat is scheduled to happen May 27th through the 29th with special guests Jerry LaFemina and former SAFTAcast guest Corinna McGlynn will be on hand and help young poets, old poets, whatever your skill levels, whatever your experience levels are, in a wonderful workshop-laden weekend of activities. To get involved with this and to get involved with our fiction retreat, which is happening June 10th through the 12th, just a couple weeks after the poetry retreat, and the guests at the fiction retreat are the awesome Sarah Gerkensmeyer and Emily Capitini, just in case you want to know. Head on over to sundresspublications.com, click on the link for store. There you can get the pricing information and such and tell you what's all involved with that price. And if you want the full details, as I said, go to sundresspublications.com, click on SunTrust Academy for the Arts in the menu bar. These are going fast, my friends. There is limited space on both the poetry and fiction, and they are filling up. You want in on this? Get in on this. All right, on to today's interview. We have a great one for you, my friends. Episode 51 with Saba Saeed Razvi. It is a great, very eclectic one, as you will see. It just goes all over the map with some amazing conversation topics. We talk about Texas. I'm surprised that I still remember the Texas commercials that used to run in the 1990s. I don't know why. Weird how our brains remember odd things. But there's so much more involved here. Saba tells us about her love of pens, her travels around the world, especially into Ireland, and much, much more. It's not just about travel, though. Oh, no. You're going to learn a lot today on the program. I know I learned a few things, and I know you will too. But before we get to that interview, we got to get through the theme song. We'll be right back. Hey, Saba.
Hi, how are you?
Hey, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much.
I'm so glad we got in touch with you. T.A. Noonan put us in touch with you, obviously.
Yeah, she is so great. We had a lot of fun at AWP.
That's what I've been told. She's like, you got whispered in my ears, like, you got to have Saba on the program. She is so badass.
Oh, she's pretty badass too, I have to say.
We could have a battle of the badasses.
We totally could, and it would be a rap battle, but I would lose because I'm no good at rap.
I don't think there's enough, like, badass competitions in poetry.
Yeah, there probably should be more of those. I mean, I guess if you go to some of the slam poetry contests that are really competitive, they can be pretty exciting that way. But I think poetry and the poetry community has taken a larger trend toward the supportive and the exciting and the encouraging.
Most contests are like, here, enter your manuscript and you have a chance at getting published. Versus, I think we need to have more like physical combat challenges.
We should have duels and jousts. That would be wonderful.
We could do it like Nickelodeon used to do. We could have like wild and crazy poets or something.
with slime dropping on our heads, perhaps, once in a while.
Yeah. Oh, you did slant rhyme, huh? Here. You know?
Oh, that would be fun.
Like slime and rhyme, you know?
That works, yeah.
There you go. Another million-dollar idea here on the program.
There need to be more programs about poets doing weird things.
Who does? Are you bothered by the reputation that poets seem to have in the public eye that we're all just boring, stuck-up, quiet people?
You know, sure. But I think that a lot of the people I know think of poets as a rowdy and wild and kind of crazy bunch. And I don't mind that reputation so much. But so much of poetry has become affiliated with academia and becomes a place where we think, well, all poets must think in theory all the time, right? But it's not like that.
I've told students in my classes, I'm like, look, you don't know writers until you've played Mario Kart with them.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Mario Kart brings out the inner beast in all of us, I think.
I've never heard poets curse like that. I mean, sailors blush.
Exactly. Well, I think all poets would enjoy that as a compliment.
Indeed. Anyway, Saba, it's good to have you here on the program.
Thank you. Pleased to be here.
I always like to start off the episode, though, in our interviews with the burning question that is on everyone's mind.
Oh, boy.
And today's burning question is, laundry excluded, what is your least favorite household chore?
Wow, I would have to say doing the dishes.
Why's that?
Well, you know, there is something really time-consuming about washing dishes, and I don't like it. I mean, if I could outsource any task, it would probably be the dishes. There's something about it that just reminds us that the party's already happened and it's all done, and we're not yet at the point where we're planning a new party yet. So it feels to me like the pinnacle of the ordinary.
That's a great way of putting it.
Thank you.
The pinnacle of the ordinary.
Yeah.
If I flip the coin, is there a household chore that you actively enjoy doing?
I love making the bed. It's like my favorite thing to do. And I love vacuuming too, because, you know, vacuuming the carpet, this is going to sound so nerdy and ridiculous, but there is this satisfaction that comes from getting the threads of the carpet to line up so that you have these alternating bands or patterns. It just feels like fun.
Is making the bed similar to that?
I suppose so. Growing up, we had some responsibilities at home, but not a whole lot. I have some siblings. I have two younger sisters, and we grew up with mostly a sense that we should study well and work hard. And we had a few chores to do, and among those chores was probably making the bed. But there's something incredibly rewarding about that, and I don't know if I relate it to my childhood and just remembering that this was the first thing that we did in the mornings, and you come back home to a nice clean bed. It feels like this platform or a canvas once you're done making that bed, and you can feel kind of proud of it or excited by it. And You can decorate it with pillows or you can just make it nice and flat, but pulling out, you know, wrinkles and smoothing the comforter and things like that, it just feels like setting, it feels like setting the place or the table for something interesting. And you know that when you come back, it's going to be waiting there for you. And maybe dreams have collected in that space while you were gone. And you might be able to go into that world of dreams when you rest at the end of the day. But there's something really peaceful about that act. And it, it's one of the first thing I do when I wake up is make the bed every day.
I feel ashamed now because I always looked at it as, what's the point? I'm going to climb back in this in like 12 hours. So, and no one's coming in the bedroom today. I don't have guests. Why?
It feels like icing a cake, maybe something a little bit more like that too.
Perhaps I'm going to have to, I'll respect you on that though.
You got to try it. Try it for a week and your attitude will change.
Maybe. Do a little bit of work, you know, quick housework in the morning there before you get into anything.
If the work involves doing dishes, I'm not an advocate of that. So
now I'm going to sound contrary here, but that's the thing I do enjoy.
Really? Oh my God, tell me why it's enjoyable.
It's meditative to me.
Yeah.
It's kind of zen-like.
Huh.
I picked that up, I think, from a book on mindfulness and Zen philosophy many years ago, where one of the chapters deals with the monastery and the monks washing the dishes.
Oh, wow.
A single dish at a time and focusing only on that dish.
Huh.
I also listen to like podcasts or music when I do it now. I have a little speaker for my phone next to the kitchen. So that also helps go along because I'll just start singing along to whatever's in the radio.
Oh, wow. Well, now that's interesting because I always listen to music when I'm doing housekeeping sorts of things and it makes it feel a little bit more exciting. But, well, you know, I'm going to think about monks when I go and do my dishes this week, like every day, and maybe I will change my mind about my least favorite chore.
I got to ask as a follow-up question. Mm-hmm. Are you one of the very few people in this world that can fold a fitted sheet?
Yes, yes, I can.
How is this possible? I've watched YouTube videos. I don't know how it's done.
It's, you know, I think the trick is in finding the angles in the sheet itself. And so there's this sense of like, I will usually lay the sheet down on something clean, like a comforter, or I'll just hold both the sides up. And I'm really short. So it's kind of hilarious to watch me fold any kind of bedding because I'm only 5 feet tall. So everything is much bigger than my arms can stretch. but finding, you know, tucking the bottom part in and finding those edges and those angles creates a kind of flat space. And it feels a little bit like origami to me.
Huh. I never thought about that.
And it's a challenge, right? Because if I fold the bed sheet and I haven't gotten the angles or the lines quite right, I'll usually try it again.
Just trial and error then.
Mm-hmm. I think so. It's like you tuck the corners in. Think of like a piece of paper with rounded edges, like someone gives you, one of the sort of journals that have become really popular nowadays that have the rounded edges. And, you know, you tear out a piece of paper and you give it to someone. Those rounded edges are nice because they won't stab you. But if you were to try and fold that piece of paper so that it didn't have those rounded edges, like, you know, you'd tuck one corner in like you were gift wrapping something. And then you might tuck in the next one that's perpendicular to it in the same way. And so on and so forth. You can kind of make a little frame around the outside so that if you were to put the piece of paper upside down, it would be like a platform. If you imagine the paper as something really, really big and really flexible, it's kind of the same as a sheet.
I feel like in my brain's like, can we construct a 3D model of this?
Yeah. Well, I mean, try it with a piece of paper. Try it with a really big piece of paper.
I will try and find a piece of paper the size of my bedding. And practice on it.
It might take two people to make it happen. Now, what's even more complicated than folding a bed sheet is folding a sari. I don't know if you've ever done that or if you know what a sari is, but it's like 6 feet of fabric, and that's so hard to fold if you've ever tried it. It can be a challenge.
Okay, is it 6 feet, like just a giant rectangle in 6 feet?
I think so. Like, all the ones I've seen have been. But it's like you've got this long ribbon that's really, really wide, essentially, and you're trying to fold it in a way that, that makes sense. But it's like a bed sheet for a giant, maybe. Really tall and skinny giant.
You don't just, say, start at one end and just roll it up like a little cigar?
I don't think I've ever done that, no.
I learned that trick for packing, so now I do it just unconsciously for all shirts and pants in my closet. Just roll them up and stick them in a drawer.
Now, packing is one of my very favorite things to do, and also the thing that stresses me out all the time. I watch YouTube videos on how to pack suitcases sometimes, because I'm convinced that one day, just one day, I'm going to be able to fit everything into a bag. Just one bag. That's a goal. But, you know, they keep changing the requirements about the size of luggage that we're allowed to take on the airplanes. So
yes.
Just when you think you have it, it's like, oh no, I need to buy a new suitcase.
Yes. And they don't tell you that, oh, if you go over 5 pounds, here's another $50. And I'm like, what the?
Yeah.
You have to buy a scale for home. This is a conspiracy by the scale industry.
It must be.
The home scale industry. Big big weight, big scale is out to get us. Oh boy.
Yes, that is true, because by the time you get like your laptop and your notebook and your phone and your iPad and like all the 15 things that you know you're going to read in the next day and a half, right? You've already exceeded the limit that they give you. I always get hassled by TSA people because they always ask me, why does anyone need to carry this many books or this many pens?
And then you have to go through the whole thing of, well, actually, I have this degree and this degree.
Indeed. And they're like, really? And yeah, but you're carrying all these books and these pens. You already finished school. Why? Do you have a favorite pen?
I do, actually. I kind of like, and this is not a plug, I kind of like Pilot's like G2s.
Oh, I've never tried that one.
They're just, I've always liked them. I used to love the cheap Bic ones.
Yeah.
But then I got a job and I was like, hey, there are better quality pens out there.
Yeah. Yeah. Pens are one of my favorite things as well. I like them a lot.
Where did you collect them as a kid? Is that where it starts with you?
No, I don't think so. I feel like writing, drawing, marking things down, and I'm always writing things down. So like if you see me, I always have a notebook and I'm always scribbling down the things that people tell me. Like I just wrote down Pilot G2 on a post-it note. I also love post-its, so you'll find post-its everywhere in my life. But I'm really drawn to the writing implement or the instrument. It just kind of feels like an extension of my hand, and it's a way of being in the world. And I love refillable pens for some reason, like, you know, and they're all different. They feel different in your hands. They bring out a different stroke. They bring out a different mood when you use them. And there's just like, I always have to have the right pen for the mood, even if the only thing I'm doing is writing a grocery list.
So there are pens probably scattered all through your house.
Oh my God. Yes.
Like, do you have a favorite? Well, you mentioned, are there a particular brand or a particular one that you're like really fond of?
You know, I actually really like Cross. I like their ink. I like their blue ballpoint ink right now. That's kind of my favorite, because I've noticed that it doesn't go through the paper and sort of seep through to the other side. Like I like to write in notebooks. I'm really old school that way. And it just feels like I'm making my mark on something, and I'm active that way. And so I'll jot things down all the time, and I'll go back and revisit old notebooks. And one of the things that horrified me was finding a notebook and seeing that the ink had just seeped through to the other side. So neither side was legible anymore. And it felt like a betrayal. And I was so mad at my notebook, and I was so mad at my pen. And I said, never again, this is not going to happen again. And so I picked up one of these testing markers that tell you whether the page is acid-free or kind of safe. And even that didn't work, because the black inks always bled through to the other side, and it just drove me crazy. So I said, okay, I'm going to keep trying. And I found a blue ink that I really like, and it's Cross who makes them. And there's just these little ballpoint refillable things, and them for like not very much on eBay, but they don't seep through to the other side. So
When your book came out in the Crocodile Gardens, did you buy a specific pen for signings?
You know, I I brought like 5 pens with me when I came out to LA to AWP to do the signing over there. And I had to think really carefully about what I was going to take with me, because some pens will leak on the plane. And I have ruined many things that way with ink that just sort of explodes on the pen. So I had to be really careful which one I brought. But I think the pen that I brought with me is made out of wood, and it seems to be carved in this interesting sort of double, there are like 2 barrels on either side of a bronze band, and it fits really nicely in the hand. It feels natural, and it's wood. I like the natural world quite a bit, and it makes me think that I'm somehow connected to it, I guess. And it had blue ink in it, so it didn't leak ink all over the place when I brought it with me.
Do you collect pens in the sense of like, you've got to get this pen, but you're never going to use it?
Oh, no. I always use the pens that I get. I feel like I collect pens, but I do so really erratically, like not with any kind of idea in mind about the collectability of a pen or monetary value. It's just, I like this and it evokes this mood or this kind of feeling, so I have to have it. And if there's a feeling that I don't think is conveyed by a writing implement, I might try to fill that by obtaining something that I can use to evoke that feeling. So I do have lots of different pens. Like I have one that I bought just in grad school from a bookstore, and it didn't even cost very much, but it's this strange kind of metallic, really heavy sort of feel. And it's really heavy in the hands, and it looks a little bit like a pole for a lamp, like a rod holding up a lamp. And I always think about that when I use that pen, like, this would be holding light somewhere if it had a different life. So I have this weird relationship to my tools and the objects in my world that I use for what I do. But I don't think that it has anything to do with any logic outside of my own headspace.
It's just something you dig.
Yeah. It's kind of one of my weird little nerdy things.
Everybody's got their obsessions.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Be it a television show, be it whatever. And that's what we love on this program, is that every writer has their obsessions.
Yes, I completely agree. I had I'd gone to Ireland for a thing that I did there. And I went to see the Book of Kells when I was over there. And one of the things I loved about the Book of Kells exhibit was that there was this video showing us how the monks had used their various tools to create their manuscripts. And it was so strange and meditative and kind of beautiful, because there was no music set to the background or anything like that. There was no soundtrack. It was just us listening to these tools that were being manipulated to create books, like folding paper and creasing paper and scratching out letters. And there was just something really kind of amazing about that moment and seeing that. And I think I relate to the various tools that I use in my life in a similar way. Not that I'm monastic at all, but I just, there's a sort of sanctity to those elements that really just pleases me.
You create your own sacredness.
Yeah, I think so. Maybe.
Are there other things? You mentioned post-it notes a moment ago.
Yeah.
Are they also part of this sacred obsession?
No, probably not. I think post-it notes feel really, really practical, and they feel a lot like progress to me. And so, you know, I can grab them and I can put them on whatever notebook I have, or I can shuffle them around in whatever notebook I'm carrying. I like notebooks a lot. And in my home, in my writing space, I have a shelf which is just notebooks, and I have to have just the right mood, just the right mode, just the right thing, and I have to commit to it, because it feels like a commitment every time I pick up a notebook. I have to look at it and say, okay, can I use this whole page, the space of this page, all of these pages, because I don't like to switch to a new notebook until I'm finished with that one. So if I get really tired of a notebook like halfway through, then it's a challenge to myself. I have to fill that up with observations and things like that very quickly if I want to move on to the next one. So notebooks, pens, things like that. Yes. Post-it notes I just like because I think I like the size of them and the way they frame a thought. And then you can just sort of move them around and they stick on things. So it's really just valuable.
They feel more urgent if it's on a post-it note.
I think so. I do my lesson plans on post-it notes sometimes too. I mean, I do them, but then I also make a little post-it note with a little summary of my lesson plans before I go in to teach a class. So it's like right there and I can look at it and I can access each item in my head so I know where we are in the agenda.
A quick note to yourself, like, you know, Williams quote.
Aha. Yes. Make sure you talk about Gilgamesh here, right? Yep.
Insert Gilgamesh. Got it.
Insert Gilgamesh. That needs to be on something. I like that. It sounds like a title.
I would put it on a t-shirt, but then I think people might get the wrong idea.
I think so. There need to be plenty of t-shirts with wrong idea making slogans or statements on them, though.
I've always wanted to create a few of myself. What was that? Oh, yeah. The movie was better.
Ah, yes. That would offend so many people.
But it's true in a few cases. I mean,
sometimes, yes.
I've had the discussion with people. I'm like, Jaws is an okay novel, good film.
Ah.
The Godfather right. is a good book, great film.
Yeah, that's true.
And I'm discounting novelizations because those are almost always terrible.
Right. Yeah. They're reductive and they sort of miss the point in so many ways.
And there's so many that aren't needed. There's a YouTube channel called Audiobooks of the Damned.
Audiobooks of the Damned?
And it's a group of people who read the novelizations of pretty much movies you never even knew had a novelization to them.
Oh my God, that's hilarious. I love that.
It's like, what? There's a novelization of Sylvester Stallone's Cobra?
What?
Why?
That's crazy.
So,
oh my God, I bet there's some found poetry in there somewhere.
Has to be. I'm sure of it.
I am envisioning a flash mob of people silently standing somewhere wearing t-shirts that have bizarre statements on them, all drawn from novelizations of films. It would be amusing.
There needs to be more snarky lit t-shirts.
Oh, yes. I agree. I definitely agree. I would like a t-shirt that says it's on the syllabus.
I actually have a stamp that I use.
Do you really?
I have a custom stamp made for me that says it's on the syllabus.
Oh, my God. That's fantastic.
Back to the notebooks for a second. You were mentioning that you go back on your old notebooks and such.
Yeah.
I know myself and many other writers, when we look back on our older stuff in old notebooks, mm-hmm. we just cringe and want to crawl into a ball and die. Is that the case with you, or do you find some pleasure in looking back on the stuff that there's a reason why it wasn't published?
Well, yeah, I suppose it's a little bit of both, you know? Sometimes I go back and look at notebooks and think, oh, look at all these things I found that I did that I forgot about. And I was talking about my trip to Ireland. It was a couple of years ago. And while I was there, I had stayed at Lismore Castle. It was part of the Abroad Writers Conference. It was really fun. I recommend that for anyone who's interested. And Lismore is really interesting and gorgeous kind of place with lots of history and things like that. But there was something about it that really kind of inspired this strange narrative in my head. And I don't usually tend toward the narrative in my work. I love to read it, but I don't tend toward it automatically in my work. Well, while I was there, I ended up just being obsessed by these characters that I saw in my head and the space that I was in. And I wrote all these pages. And, you know, I didn't really come back and look at it. I left that notebook. That notebook was finished. I put it away and was focusing on a different one. And I was hanging out with a friend who is really awesome, Jilly Dreadful. And if you don't know her, her work is really great too. We were hanging out and talking about some of the stuff that we were working on and going through old notebooks. I was going through an old notebook and I was looking at that one. And I thought, I wrote this. I wrote like a 70-page thing. And I was going back and reviewing it. It's not that bad. I actually kind of like it. And so it was surprising and sort of wonderful in those moments. And I always do find notes for things that I'd like to develop I often cringe at the things I've written about my life in the moment. So the cringeworthy stuff is usually, oh God, I'm talking about that issue that happened in my life once. Let's never go back to revisit that ever again. Or I'll find poems that just never worked, or drafts of poems or scraps of poems or things like that that just never worked. And I usually look at that as an opportunity to go back and mine them for something that's valuable and worthwhile in that moment. So I sometimes there are some seriously cringeworthy things in there, but it also kind of feels like an adventure.
You know, in high school and early college, I probably filled 12 notebooks, but I like to joke that I didn't write my first poem until I was 30.
Oh, wow. I like that.
Burn all the other books, you know.
Yeah, I'm going to pretend I didn't write anything in high school.
I'm going to pretend I didn't either.
No, that didn't. That time didn't exist.
Bad Nirvana knockoffs.
Bad Nirvana knockoffs are wonderful.
Not 25 years later.
I hear you. Oh, goodness.
Wait, you may not trend to the narrative in your work, but let's get into a little narrative here. Sure. I know you're in Texas.
Mm-hmm.
Were you born in Texas?
I wasn't. I was actually born in Chicago, but I moved to Texas with my family when I was like 3. My dad was a mechanical engineer, and so he moved down to Texas because there's a lot of oil and gas industry stuff down here. And I had a sister at the time. We were both born in Chicago, and then my other sister was born in Houston. So there were 5 of us, and we lived in Houston. And I've lived mostly in the same place since I was little, although I moved around a lot as a person. So I went to college in Nebraska. I spent some time in various states just because travel is one of the things I really, really love. And I like going to new places and discovering them and finding them. I don't always live in those places, but I like to dwell in other places for a time and just sort of absorb whatever it is about that space. I lived in Austin for a few years where I did a degree. I lived in Los Angeles for many years where I studied as well and loved it. I thought it was wonderful. I spent plenty of time in Chicago, New York, various other places. I like to travel internationally when I can as well, but there are a lot of places I haven't seen that I'd love to go to. But I grew up in Texas, and I've spent quite a lot of time in Texas, although I don't sound like it most of the time, according to most people, unless I'm really mad. Apparently, when I'm really, really mad, I sound like I'm from Texas. So thankfully, that doesn't happen too often.
You may travel a lot and everything, but why is Texas the home base for you? Is there a specific reason that, yeah, Texas is like always going to be the center for me?
Well, I would have to say it's family. You know, I'm close to my family. My father passed away last year. It's like almost been a year, and it's quite awful. I mean, grief is just one of the most awful things in the world. I was really close to my dad. And so that's been pretty rough, but my mom and my sisters are here, and I have so many cousins. Like, my dad had 10 brothers and sisters, my mom had like 2 siblings, and all of them have many kids, and some of them have kids, and some of them have kids. So I have this massive family in Houston. And it's kind of awesome, so it always feels like home base because there's kind of a built-in community there, and we all get along, so it feels welcoming and it feels kind of lovely, but there's also something really weird about Texas too. And I don't know if it's growing up here or the fact that we learn Texas history, we learn about the culture. There's something uniquely cohesive about Texas that makes people just want to identify with it sometimes, or maybe not identify with it sometimes in some cases. And it's a weird place that I both love and that I think drives me absolutely batty sometimes, you know?
Texas, a land of contradictions.
Yes, that is definitely what it is. Although I live in, I work in Victoria, Texas, which is just outside of Houston. And I like to call it the land of secret bacon because there is bacon in everything. You wouldn't expect it to be in everything, but it's in everything.
Including the water.
Including the water sometimes, you know. But yeah, the land of many things, but contradictions being one of them.
It's like a sixth grade history report, you know. Oh, talk about this country. In short, this is a land of contrasts.
Yeah. It's a big state, you know, and there's a lot here. And as a child, I explored a lot of it. You know, we went on road trips pretty often, went to little towns and visited them, learned about the history of the place. And that was kind of nice. And I mean, you can find all kinds of landscape and interesting things. And as a person who is drawn to nature and the natural world in general, I really enjoy being able to find different kinds of landscapes and different kinds of flora and fauna and connection here.
As someone who's never been to Texas, mm-hmm. what are some of the hot spots of Texas that I should hit sometime that aren't maybe the big ones that all tourists would go to?
Sure. Well, everyone will tell you to go to South by Southwest in Austin, but I will tell you that you should just go to Austin when it's not South by Southwest. Because there's quite a lot to see there. It's really, really very interesting. And a lot of folks don't talk much about Houston, but Houston's pretty exciting. It's a really multicultural city, very cosmopolitan. It feels like an international city. There's a huge art scene here as well. There's a symphony. There are museums. There are tons of museums. So if you like art, and I really love art, so it's valuable and fun to check those kinds of things out. They have all kinds of cuisines. So if you like trying new things, that's another aspect of Houston that's pretty awesome. Denton, Texas is really interesting because they've got quite a big art scene over there. And Victoria might surprise you because there are some really cool things happening in Victoria, Texas right now too. Like, we've got a film festival, which is kind of unusual and kind of funky. We've got some interesting reading series connected to the university here. You have people coming from all over the place. Those are kind of good. I recommend Marfa. People really like it and think it's kind of beautiful. My favorite place in Texas is probably Brazos Bend Park.
What's so awesome about that?
Well, there are alligators. There are alligators and really, really trippy trees. The trees have these bizarre branches that just kind of go everywhere. And they're so unusual and strange and wonderful to look at. And there's moss and it's just gorgeous. And it kind of feels like you're in this really creepy, swampy fairyland. And for some reason, I really just get a kick out of that.
Marfa, is that the town that has only like 7 people in it?
It's a town that has like an artist retreat and a whole lot of things related to that. Now, geography is not always my strong suit because I tend to conflate time and space in all kinds of weird manners and don't think about it. But what I recall of Marfa is that it feels kind of like desert and mountainous at the same time. There's a lot of green, but it's really dry. It feels kind of like a greener, more verdant sort of Joshua Tree. If you've ever been to Joshua Tree in California. But they have a number of different things out there. There are some galleries. It's a really small town, but there is a lot of art out there.
Yeah, I remember where I heard of Marfa. That's the town in Texas that has the Lone Prada store on the side of the road.
I didn't know about that.
Well, I don't know if it's still there, but
there and check it out. You'll find a lot of outlet stores here too. I suppose you'll find those anywhere, but in really surprising parts of Texas, you'll find outlet malls and weird shopping, good antiques, strangely good antiques, and some really interesting places if you like that kind of thing. Galveston has really cool stuff. I don't know if you've ever been to Galveston. Well, you said you hadn't been to Texas. So
no,
Galveston's another place that I would recommend going to. I think it's been around since like 1505 and it's old and there's all kinds of really weird and interesting things to look at there.
Texas sounds a lot more hip than I think the national view of it is.
It's not all what you see on the news, honestly. I mean, we do have this thing now where universities kind of let people bring guns to campus, which is a little bit on the strange side. But you know, there is that. People like to shoot things and barbecue things, but people also dig their art and their nature and their history as well. So
I might have to spend some time traveling to Texas. I've wanted to ever since the 90s with the flood of commercials that used to be on TV. Call 1-800-888-TEX for your Texas travel guide.
I don't think I've ever seen one of those.
Don't know why I remember that.
Well, I would recommend Austin, definitely. If you've never been to Austin, I think they have like a slogan for the city, which is something like, keep it weird. And so you'll find all kinds of really exciting things there. And that's pretty fun. But if you're ever out for the Victoria Film Festival, that's one to check out. There's a Bach festival here, which puts on interesting musical concerts throughout the summer as well. And a reading series, a few reading series that are actually out here too. Should give it a try.
Might definitely have to in the future. You mentioned that there are places that you've traveled around quite a bit internationally and such, but you also mentioned there are some places that you wish you could go to and you haven't gotten there yet.
Yeah.
What are some of those places?
Well, some of them are places that I feel like I just couldn't travel right now because the political climate makes them a little bit unsafe. I would love to go to Egypt. I think that would be really, really amazing. I've never seen the pyramids, and I'd like to do that one day. I would love to see the Sahara. That would be really wonderful. Petra would be so great to see. And I have this sort of interest in the desert and big, broad, expansive, dune-filled deserts. And I'd like to go see one somewhere out there. If I could go somewhere, I might go to Istanbul. Lately, that's been sort of on my mind. Or maybe Morocco is another place that I'd like to see.
Why that? Why those places?
I think there's something about the landscape that I've seen in pictures and in videos, but I feel like I've never been in it or connected to it in a way that I have many other kinds of landscapes. And so it's just kind of been on the horizon of my mind, I suppose, lately, and thinking about how we fit in and how we belong to the different spaces in the world.
What are some of the more favorite places you've been to? You've mentioned Ireland a couple of times, yeah. So I'm guessing Ireland is up there on the list. What are some of the other places you've been to that you just, if given the chance, you would go right back to?
Oh,
tomorrow?
Gosh, there's so many places. I mean, I think every time I go somewhere, I think I don't want to leave. I just want to stay here, you know? But that has something to do with that sort of adventurous and exploratory mindset of travel in the first place. So I think I just like liminal spaces, including just being out there in the world. But New Orleans is one of those places. I love New Orleans. Scotland is really, really beautiful. Barcelona, I went to a conference there recently and just absolutely loved it. I thought it was wonderful. I had such a great time. And I love the city and the attitude about the city. Bern is also really gorgeous. It's got some wonderful, wonderful mountains that I liked looking at. I don't think I ever really reflected on how much I respond to the landscape of a particular place or of places in general, but that seems to be on my mind a lot today.
No, I can totally understand. Coming in Florida where it's flatland and swamp, I grew up though surrounded by mountains.
Oh, wow.
So I miss that down in the South. I miss, you know, right outside my door, a 5-minute walk, there's 1,600 feet of river-made stone.
Oh my gosh, right. There's mountains are kind of amazing. I mean, having grown up in Texas, where it is often really, really flat. I mean, like if you go up to Austin, it can be really hilly, but Houston and around Houston, so it's sort of the Gulf Coast region, it is really flat. When I moved to California for the first time, I just remember being completely in awe of the mountains. I would just look at them and think, how on earth does the land do that? I just don't understand. And I just look at them and be really transfixed. And they always call to me. I find them really, really delightful and kind of exciting. I like mountains a lot. And I find, so I've never lived in Florida, but I've been to Florida. And in high school, I took a trip with some of my cousins to Disney World because, you know, of course, why not?
Everyone has to go at some point.
Exactly. It's kind of fun. And now they have Harry Potter World, which is just so cool.
So, yeah, I've got to check that out.
But I drove with my cousins from Houston to Florida. And one of the things I remembered was that the landscape just kind of calls out to you. And there were so many swamps along the way. And it kind of became a running joke among us, among our group, because as we were driving, we would just sort of randomly see swamps. And at first it was pretty exciting. Oh, look, it's a swamp. Oh, look, it's a swamp. And then it just sort of became this running joke that randomly people would call out the word swamp whenever we'd see one. And for no reason at all, other than the fact that we were on the road for such a long time, it became really hilarious. And even now, I think if I were to say that to one of my cousins, they would probably start laughing.
I'm just picturing now going on the Jungle Cruise at Disney World. Look, swamp all around us. Look.
Right.
You stop at the joke, stop being funny on Main Street USA.
Of course. It's like, it stops being funny, but you can't stop laughing because it's just become so ridiculous and absurd at some point.
That's one of the greatest things of all road trips is the road trip inside jokes that come out.
Yes. Oh my goodness. I agree.
Can't explain them to anyone because if you explain an inside joke, it becomes not funny.
Yeah, it just doesn't make any sense. It's like, really? What? You okay? what is the most interesting road trip you've ever taken?
Oh, most interesting, maybe not for good reason. Or for, I'm trying to think if there's been a really good one.
Yeah.
I know there were ones in high school. They were local, like regional, like within an hour with my friends in high school. I can name one of the worst I ever was on. And it's only because of the situation was I had to drive 16 hours.
Oh.
And I was in a van with the girl who had broken my heart like 2 weeks before.
Oh, no.
And so it was a rough ride. And I drove.
I was suspended in heartbreak. Can't imagine that. That would be wild. I mean, road trips tend to bring our emotions out and up to the surface anyway, but when you're going through them, that's got to be something else.
I've made my peace with it.
I think the longest road trip I've ever taken was probably between Houston and Los Angeles.
Was that just recent for AWP?
No. It was when I used to live there and I had traveled with someone at the time, and we had taken an interesting and circuitous route back to Los Angeles, which involved stopping at Roswell, New Mexico at one point, which I just thought was so bizarre and weird and kind of fun. But that was a really long road trip. There were a lot of interesting things along the way, and you pass so much space and so much land, and there are so many kinds of terrain. I don't know if I'm even saying that right, but the terrain changes so rapidly and also gradually at the same time that it was kind of interesting. It was a long road trip. I remember enjoying that, but it was some years ago. So not to AWP.
Well, it's coming up on road trip season now. You know, it's getting to be late spring. Road trips are starting. People are starting to think about their family vacations.
Mm-hmm.
As a seasoned veteran of the road, what tips could you give people about like how to make the road trip better?
Wow. Well, don't overpack, you know. We have sometimes in our minds an idea that we're going to need a million and one things on that road trip. But one of the most exciting things about road trips, in my opinion, is the stuff that you don't expect to encounter, you know, and giving yourself enough time to discover those things and think about those things and look at those things is really worthwhile. And it's a lot harder to do when you are weighed down with huge suitcases that are taking up all your space in the car and making you feel kind of squished and cramped. And not stopping to look at things that surprise you or inspire you is probably a bad idea. So I think it's a good idea to stop and look at those things that surprise you and that catch your interest. I mean, I would never have there's some caverns. I think they're called Carlsbad Caverns out west somewhere in between Houston and Los Angeles. Right now, I'm just not remembering where they are. If it's either New Mexico or Arizona or something like that. But I never would have encountered them if I had planned on where I was going. But it's one of the coolest places I've ever been, and I recommend others to go there. I think it'd be really delightful, but I wouldn't have found it if I had followed a plan. So I guess if there's any advice I could give about road trips or travel in general, make a plan for yourself so you have an idea of where you're going to go, but be open to the possibility of discovering something new and unusual, and don't be overly committed to the plan of how you get where you're going.
As I often have said, one of my favorite lines in any song is, the point of the journey is not to arrive.
Yeah.
And the point of departure is not to return.
Oh, that's really wonderful. I like that. I mean, there's also the idea that travel is a kind of revision of the self. But, I mean, we're always moving from one place to another, from one time to another, from one experience to another. And I think it's really easy to get hung up on getting to a certain place or getting to a certain place in a certain way, and choosing to be open and receptive to adventure makes it so much more meaningful and exciting and valuable.
I never thought about it like that. I just enjoy, I'm one of those people that you tell me, hey, we're going to drive, you know, 9-10 hours. And I always say that I have the ass of a trucker. You know, sure, put me in the driver's seat. Yeah. I'll drive. I don't mind. I like it.
That's awesome.
There's something about those long meditative drives.
Yes. Well, see, you're meant to visit Texas because there are all kinds of long open freeways, and it's beautiful and meditative and really gorgeous to drive through it. You kind of feel like you're suspended in ocean in certain places, like especially as you're driving out west towards El Paso and things like that. But there are these beautiful long open roads, and the romance of the horizon and the American dream and just kind of possibility, that's all out there, you know.
Texas is calling, Scott. Will you accept the charges?
Exactly.
No, maybe it is. Maybe I should make a date for Texas one of these days.
Don't run out of gas there, though. You'll regret running out of gas.
That's something I've learned about Alabama, of all places.
Really?
If you take 59, which bisects the state, gas, there's three cities you got to know: Montgomery, Birmingham, and forget the other one on the other, Meridian.
Really?
Three cities. They're almost 2 hours apart from each other. And in between are 2 hour stretches of nothing.
Wow.
No gas stations, no bathrooms. You just basically, you stop in each city, gas up, go take care of everything, and then hit.
Oh my gosh.
I may be wrong, but that's certainly what it feels like when driving it.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, there are probably all kinds of little towns and little spaces tucked away that you don't see or that you aren't aware of when you're doing the drive. But if you looked at a map and found where they were and went to explore them, it would change your sense of that terrain and that space. That's one of the things I discovered about Texas, because you've got like big cities and they're far away from each other, but there are a lot of little towns and little cities on the way that you don't automatically notice when you're on the highway. But if you take a little detour, you'll find them, and you'll find lots and lots of history and depth and people that are often really friendly. Sometimes they're really not, but sometimes they're really cool.
Tip number three, get off the interstate sometimes.
Yeah. Yeah, I would say so. And 59 just goes everywhere. That's a great one. And 10. 10 is great too.
10's the panhandle here in Florida.
Oh, I see.
A tough slog to do.
Oh, no.
It is. It's a tough slog. If you look at a map of Florida, it takes the whole panhandle, but places like Destin and the Gulf Coast are about 45 minutes or an hour or so from that highway. So the actual highway itself is really kind of, I hate to say it, but kind of dull.
Oh, yeah.
That stretch.
It's a great way to sing along to music and remember the lyrics that you have forgotten over time, right?
Or to realize that you remember every word.
Oh, yeah.
Like, I haven't heard this song in 20 years. How do I know it still?
Right. I love singing in the car. That's one of, I don't sing, like I don't do karaoke or anything like that. I don't usually sing in public, but I love singing in the car. It's one of my favorite things to do.
Have you ever had an experience where you're singing in the car and another car responds to you?
No, I have not. But that makes me think of Bohemian Rhapsody.
I had it happen in this past week with the death of Prince. I'm driving down the road listening to Erotic City.
Right.
And, you know, here I am just listening to Erotic City and windows down because blasting it because why not? And somebody pulls up next to me at a stoplight and just looks over and nods their head at me knowingly. Oh. And I was like, mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think, I mean, this year and the loss of amazing, amazing musical artists is so strange. I mean, Prince, it's shocking. And David Bowie and
Maurice White of Earth, Wind and Fire and Merle Haggard. I'm worried for people like Willie Nelson right now.
I know. I was talking to a friend the other day and I just said, all the icons of my childhood are disappearing. I don't really know what to do because the landscape of the world has changed.
I got used to it when I did an inventory of my record collection and realized that about 79% of them were already dead. Yeah. Oh, well.
Yeah. Well, I guess, well, we all have an expiration date. So, did you have a favorite Prince song?
Yes, actually I do. Mm-hmm. And that is The Most Beautiful Girl in the World.
Oh, that's a good one.
I love that song. And I love the concept of the video for it. Basic concept was, there's this mysterious theater where women come into and they see their deepest fantasies projected on a screen for them.
Oh, wow.
And they get to live their fantasy for a few minutes mm-hmm. and experience their dream. And I wish it had gone further in the concept.
Yeah.
But it's one of my favorites of his. Did you have a favorite Prince song?
Oh, you know, I think like so much of what Prince did was just wonderful and amazing. And the one song that's been looping in my head, I suppose, since I heard the news about Prince is Little Red Corvette. It's just in my head. I like that one. My mind keeps coming back to that one because I remember it most vividly. But I think everything Prince did was unusual and interesting and amazing, much like David Bowie, I think, as well. There was real artistry and vision and passion and dedication. And I think that came through in all of the projects. Yeah. And so, you know, I suppose moment by moment, my answer to that question probably changed. I think if I heard a different song, I'd say, no, I meant that one was my favorite, you know? So
we could sit here and probably talk about music artists and favorite songs for a while, but I'm looking at our time here. It's like, where did this hour go?
Oh my God. Has it been an hour? That's amazing.
It has been about an hour with us. And I'm just looking at my notes here. It's like, we've touched on almost everything. This is a very eclectic episode, I think. I'm not complaining. I love that.
I'm really random that way. I like my tangents.
But before we let you go though, In the Crocodile Gardens just recently came out through Agape.
Yes. You should check it out if you haven't.
But what else do you have coming down the pipe right now? What's on the horizon for you in your work?
Oh my goodness. I'm always working on projects and they kind of revolve around me and in my world, and I kind of feel like I navigate the world through them. But I am currently chapbook forthcoming, and it's called Beside the Muazzin's Call and Beyond the Harem's Veil. And it deals a lot with the lives of Muslim Americans and sort of that space between what we see in the media and the reality of the experience. So I've got that forthcoming, which is something. I have a bunch of academic work that I've been focusing on, and some of that deals a lot with science and the relationship between science and contemporary poetry. And related to that is a project that I've been working on for many, many years. It's a long poem about robots and robotics, and it kind of plays with the idea of the ideal woman and the Pygmalion myth and the idea of how we program a thing to know a thing and what that thing is in the first place. And so it's this kind of narrative cycle of a bunch of different poems, and they're all in experimental and playful form. They're all kind of different. It's called Waking Galatea, and I've been working on it for a really long time. And I'm hoping to finish its last revision sometime this summer. And I'm writing a novel. So I've been working on this novel for quite a while as well. And I'm not sure what's going to happen with it or where it's going to go. But those are the two big projects that I've been kind of writing at this point in time.
Most kick-ass. You're prolific here, putting a lot of us to shame, I feel like.
Oh, no, I don't know about that. I work on projects for a long, long time, and I don't like to let them go until I feel like they're really done or until I've said everything that I want to say. So I kind of juggle a lot of things at once, and I'm obsessed with a lot of things. So I'm like, okay, well, this one's got to go to this project, and so on and so forth.
Well, keep pumping out the awesome work, because and for our listeners who haven't checked it out, I do encourage you to check out In the Crocodile Gardens, because there it is fantastic.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Fantastic stuff.
That cover art, isn't that amazing?
It is so funktastic. I love it.
It's so wild and gorgeous and bright and colorful. Carrie Ann Bodd, I believe that's how you say her last name, is like my favorite artist. I just love her work. I've never met her. I don't know her. I hear she has connections to Florida, but and you mentioned Florida earlier, so I'm just throwing that out there. But she is like my favorite artist ever, and I was so stoked when she agreed to let me use her art. I was like, oh my God, I feel like a rock star right now just by proximity, right? It's a beautiful painting. So if you haven't seen it, I recommend it.
And then look at it multiple times, because every time you look at it, there's something more to see in it.
Yes.
It's so detailed.
I agree. And all of her work is equally amazing. I mean, it's just hypnotic and transfixes you. I was just so, so happy that she allowed me to use that.
It is totally awesome, and it has been totally awesome chatting with you.
Thank you, and you as well. I can't believe we've been talking for an hour.
I feel like we haven't touched on some things. Like you mentioned about science and literature. Man, we could have a discussion about that, and I'm sure we could find other things to nerd about.
Of course. Science, board games, science fiction, Doctor Who.
Open invitation. Feel free to come back whenever you'd like. We'll have you on again and just catch up and chat about more stuff.
That sounds awesome, and I think we should talk one day about nerdy science fiction stuff, because that is totally my bag.
Oh, well, I am totally on board with that.
Cool.
We can rant and rave.
That sounds awesome.
All right, Saba, it has been a pleasure. Take care. We'll talk to you soon.
You have an awesome day.
You too.
Bye.
The SAFTAcast is a production of the Sundress Academy for the Arts. For episodes and more, visit SAFTAcast.com. Until we talk again, this is your host, Scott C., signing off.